Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Midnight Mass podcast. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and I'm here with my fantastic co-host. It's the one, the only, it's Michael Verratti.
Well, hello, hello, Peaches, and I'm excited because this week we get to celebrate some Hollywood history, but in an X-rated way.
I love X-rated pictures.
Yes, but this isn't really like the X-rated films that we've done in the past. Not that we've really done a lot of X-rated films, but usually when people hear about an X rating, they think of pornography, and that's because...
They think of Edward Penis Hands.
I know, I do.
Yeah.
I think that the reason X kind of evokes pornography and adult cinema is because that's sort of what took on that rating after a while. And that's what it culturally became associated with, you know, triple X, et cetera, et cetera. But there was a period of time, especially before the NC-17 rating, when movies made by studios were given X ratings because of content or because they pushed things culturally that were sort of not being seen at the movies at the time. And this movie this week is certainly a button pusher, and it did earn an X rating when it was released in 1970.
Well, Michael, what is this X-rated film we're diving into?
We are talking about 1970's Myra Breckinridge, directed by Michael Sarn and based on the novel by Gore Vidal and written by Michael Sarn and David Giler, starring Raquel Welch, Mae West, John Huston, Farrah Fawcett, Rex Reed, an early appearance by Tom Selleck, and a veritable clip show of Hollywood's golden era greatest hits.
This is one of those movies that is worthy of being featured on the Midnight Mass podcast, but not for all the obvious reasons. I think normally you and I tend to do movies, which makes sense, that we love.
Yes.
And movies that we've loved and we know backwards and forwards. So many of the movies. And once in a while, we do things that we don't know as well that we fall in love with. And sometimes we do things that we loved and then we find out through reevaluation we don't maybe love them as much as we used to. This is one of those movies that both you and I have talked about a bunch. Neither of us necessarily have a love affair with it, but we're fascinated by it. It's a fascinating film.
And as I wrote in this week's episode description, as well as mentioned in one of our interviews, this is one of the rare cases where we usually say that we're celebrating the week's movie. And in a way, we are celebrating this. But this week, I think we're more so tackling Myra Breckinridge because...
That's a good way to put it.
There are things about this movie that in the pantheon of cinema and the way this movie embraces Hollywood, but also vilifies Hollywood and critiques Hollywood and celebrates Hollywood and all of these things happening at once that make it really, really fascinating, make it kind of fabulous. But there are also a lot of elements to this film that we recognize are not necessarily easy to handle. And they weren't then, and they've certainly gotten even harder to handle now. And with that in mind, I will say that if you are not familiar with the content of Myra Breckinridge, this episode certainly will come with trigger warnings. This film features sexual assault as well as transphobia.
And homophobia.
And homophobia.
Yeah.
These are all things that factor into the movie. As regular Midnight Mass listeners may know, every week we say that the show carries a trigger warning because cult cinema is, of course, subversive and deals with transgressive things. We usually kind of stand by that and we don't bring it up every week. But because Myra Breckinridge really, really goes there in some cases, we just kind of want to let you know up front. So if this is not the movie for you, that's totally fine. But otherwise, let's get into it.
Maybe some of the casual nature with which we describe things that occur in the film, there's a trigger warning just even about that, because
yes,
I do even myself get uncomfortable with some of the things that we're describing that take place in the film, namely centered around one scene in particular, which we'll get into. But before we do, how were you first introduced to this wild film?
This is one of those movies that I don't really recall my first interaction with it. I remember watching it, I think, in college when I was running through a number of films that were very popular during the 70s. I've talked on the show before that I went to Kent State University. And one thing that Kent really, really embraces and encourages is a interest in counterculture and music of the 70s and the era, you know, when Kent was in the news. And they talk about the political climate that led to the unfortunate incident that happened on our campus and May 4th, 1970. And there is this real kind of spirit of remembrance and celebration of sort of that era as well that kind of has endured in the city of Kent. And so while I was there, I watched a lot of the counterculture movies, the sort of movies that came from the Haight-Ashbury scene, that came from the bucking of the old establishment. And I was in the Film Society. So of course, as I was getting my film education, watching movies by Robert Altman or The Monkey's Head or, you know, some of the psychedelic films that Jack Nicholson was doing. I watched a lot of those there. And of course, Myra Breckinridge is part of that era, albeit a little bit different.
I actually did not see this until after college. And I do remember when I first saw it. And I remember that this is one of the rare times that I definitely was a fan of a book and read a book before I'd seen the movie, because I read, but I'm not the biggest reader. I watch movies way more than I read. But this was back when I was definitely reading more books, and I had been introduced to Gore Vidal through an older gay mentor who right. talked a lot about Gore Vidal. And so I was reading what I could, and Myra Breckinridge might have been the first thing I ever read. And I loved the book. And I thought that movie was going to be like my vision of the book. And then the movie played in San Francisco at the Red Brick Movie House on its calendar. And I went to see it, having heard about the movie. You know, also, it was a time in my life when I was fascinated by quote unquote bad movies that other people had, you know, tossed aside. I remember being really into The Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies. I was discovering the films of Ted V. Michaels. I was obviously, you know, Showgirls had just came out. And as you know, I was obsessed with Showgirls. So yeah. I was into the idea of embracing movies that other people call bad, if that makes sense. And this was a movie that I had heard was terrible, but I loved this book. So I thought, I'm going to go in and love the movie. And then I remember this was one of the first of those movies that I was discovering around that time where I left. And I was like, I have no fucking idea what I think about that movie. It is not what I thought it was going to be at all. It was absolutely not. And in all these years later, I still love being confused by it.
Well, and I think that's kind of what keeps this movie on the radar, right? I think that, as you often say, and I believe you even say later in this episode in one of our interviews, bad movies are movies that just aren't memorable. You forget about them. This movie is a movie that, for better or worse, continues to endure in conversation, which means there's something about it that has stuck. Whether those things that have stuck are the problematic elements that we're still trying to reconcile with, or the fabulous elements that we know are fabulous. That's the thing about this movie that makes it really interesting to engage with. It does so much of what those other movies that we've referenced already do by celebrating this kind of offbeat character. When Raquel Welch enters the scene, she's fabulous. She's larger than life. She's bucking the system. She's creating this anti-establishment streak that, if you are watching the movies of Ted V. Michaels, or you're watching Bob Raffleson's Head, or any of these things that we're talking about, you're like, yeah, I can get behind this. And she's doing it in an amazing sort of like sequin, glamorous way. That's something, as a queer audience, we want to love her. And then the third act of this movie really, really feels like an indictment of her character and a damnation of the audience who would get behind her. And then you're just sort of left as the credits roll, like, oh, I don't know what to think, because on one hand, there's so much of this to love, and I do want to love it. And I guess in some ways I do. And there's so much of this to be really kind of like, I guess, hurt by.
In terms of stuff to love, I mean, we might as well just go there.
Yeah.
The unapologetic presentation of queer people, including a femme gay guy played by Rex Reed, whose present day, you know, embodiment is having become a trans woman, played by Raquel Welch, is fucking fabulous, right? Like, I think we really agree that, especially at this time, trans women often were shown in movies like Dressed to Kill, where they were awkward men in bad wigs who were doing scary, horrible things. And they were big and lump, you know, they were scary. They were presented in an ugly way. This was like Raquel Welch is about the sexiest, most gorgeous Hollywood movie star they could have put in the role of a trans woman. Now, is there a problematic discussion to be had about that. Absolutely.
Sure.
But in the context of the time and when we're seeing this movie, that was something I think to be celebrated. And then you've got Mae West. So on the surface, it's like, what? This is made for queer people. But when you watch the movie, doesn't really feel that way.
It's
although
true.
Those things are there. Those elements are there, which is why it gets kind of confusing.
It is vastly confusing. You know, when we open the film and Rex Reed and Raquel Welch have that dance sequence and they're like dancing up the street and it's very kind of like Umbrellas of Cherbourg,
yes.
Kind of like Jacques Demy, like French musical, like buying into the fantasy. And it's his queer fantasy that she gets to be free. And like, she is dancing down the street, you know, the idea that they together embody this queerness that is being celebrated while they're dancing hand in hand. It's like, oh, this could be so beautiful. And then it does feel kind of like, are we about to go on this kind of queer fantasia? Not really. No.
There is this thing that happens in this movie that is kind of similar to one of the more problematic parts of Rocky Horror. This is the first time I've ever made this connection. Myra becomes obsessed with a male-female straight couple and actually talks about how American they are, both admiring them, but also being repulsed by them in a way. And Myra fully knows that she's both amazing and also kind of a freak in a way. Like,
yeah.
Her character definitely knows that she's both the fiercest thing in the room, but also still the stranger, you know, thing in the room. And the most problematic scene, and this is the one that we've been talking around, she rapes the man in this way that both you and I agree was very disturbing to watch, partly because the actor playing the victim is so realistic. Not that any scene like this isn't horrifying, but because he plays it so straight in a way that it's just very upsetting and weird and confusing, like, you know, and launches us into the third act. And then once she destroys him, it causes their breakup. And then she moves in on the girlfriend. Frankenfurter does something very similar in Rocky Horror. And I just am wondering, like, wow, there's also these fears because we're in the summer of love. We're in the sexual liberation. But there's this sort of undercurrent of like, be careful, because these queer people, they want to destroy straight people, you know, and maybe that was a queer fantasy as well. But certainly in Rocky Horror, it's all about subverting them and emasculating Brad and tricking them and seducing them. And Myra Breckinridge, you get a lot of the same stuff.
Well, does she not say in the movie that that's literally her goal? I mean, she doesn't say,
she does
it necessarily
say it
with regard to like the assault, but she says generally, like, she is there to take over the studio to end the male dominated world. That's what her plan is in the movie. And, you know, on the outside, when we first meet her and when she says that and she's kind of in this like fabulous space, you're kind of like, okay. Then it's sort of like the movie takes this very kind of establishment lens and looks at what it thinks that would be. And that's when I think the damnable things happen.
Yes, I agree. We have lined up two really great guests from two different perspectives.
Our first guest is someone that I am really excited to share a co-author credit on the upcoming Queer Horror, a Film Guide with, but her resume is exhaustive and her work is impressive in the worlds of activism and entertainment. She has done so much. She's won so many awards and she, I knew, would have a lot to say about this movie. So I'm very excited that we're about to talk about Myra Breckinridge with Calpurnia Adams right now.
It's got the F-M-I-L-E. It's gonna help considerably. Just keep your chin up and give it a try. And you'll find silver lined clouds in the sky. You've got to F-M-I-L-E to be H-A-P-P-Y.
Welcome back, listeners. When considering our next guest's many contributions to the world of activism and entertainment, the descriptor that immediately comes to mind is staggering. The winner of a Peabody Award, a GLAAD Media Award, a Task Force Media Award, and many beauty pageant crowns, this person was the star of her own MTV logo reality show, Trans American Love Story, and is the co-founder of Deep Stealth Productions, the first Hollywood production company owned and operated by out trans women. She has hosted celebrated cabaret acts and toured the world as a musical artist. She mounted the first all-trans women production of the Vagina Monologues and has performed alongside Jane Fonda at the Superdome in New Orleans. She has an exhaustive list of film credits, is a decorated war veteran, and has been an outspoken advocate for LGBTQIA+ and women's causes. And on a personal note, I'm thrilled to say I get to share space with this remarkable individual as part of Queer Horror, a film guide, an expansive book project that we both worked on as contributing authors. She's an actress, musician, author, activist, and so very much more. Please welcome Calpurnia Adams. Calpurnia, welcome to the show.
Howdy, howdy, y'all. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us, especially for this movie, because often Peaches and I will say that we're celebrating the movies that we highlight each week, and we are. But this week, I also feel like we're tackling this movie. This movie has a lot to tackle. And but because of its place in Hollywood history, it also merits a lot of discussion. And so I guess that's where we begin. What's your relationship with Myra Breckinridge? Do you have history with this movie? Where does that begin?
Well, I've been a showgirl and an entertainer ever since I could be, you know. But growing up, I grew up in a weird Southern fundamentalist cult, and we were not allowed to watch modern movies or television. You know, almost, we couldn't go to movie houses, we couldn't go to theaters, we almost couldn't watch anything that wasn't in black and white. And so I came to a lot of these movies as an adult without a lot of the background, you know, of having seen other stuff. And I think it gives me a really fresh set of eyes to look at it with. You know, I'm a trans woman. I have medically, legally, and socially transitioned many, many years ago. I think 1994 is when I started. And, you know, Myra Breckinridge is about a trans woman who kind of goes on this rampage to break down Hollywood and manhood in general. So it's super fascinating to me on every level, as a writer, a filmmaker, as an actor, as a trans woman.
Part of why we're fascinated by the film as queer people is because of its queerness. You know, Raquel Welch is a trans woman. Raquel Welch pre-transition performance, who exists in the whole movie, you know, as her sort of alter ego, is played by Rex Reed. You know, it's her identity before she's transitioned. The movie was lifted completely and taken from a book. It's based on a book by Gore Vidal, who notoriously hated the movie. Fascinating queer people in pop culture or queer icons such as Mae West. So it's like chock full of queerness. And I just wonder, in the canon of sort of cult movies, camp films, trans narratives, it's almost like you have to talk about it as different things, if that makes sense. You know, we can look at it as a movie that fits into the history of trans representation in cinema, and I would look at it a certain way with regard to that. But then if I look at it as a silly, outrageous, terrible camp, wild romp of a midnight movie, I see it in a different way. So I'm wondering, what's your relationship been like with Myra Breckinridge? And I know this is a big question, but what kind of, what are your thoughts on it? Because I think with Michael and I, we often celebrate movies that we both love. And with this film, we're certainly celebrating it. It's more of an analysis. I'm not sure that I love this movie.
Right.
I am fascinated by it, if that makes sense.
Well, I think I am different than a lot of people you might call a trans activist or a queer activist or whatever, in that I have a real messed up sense of humor and down and dirty. And, you know, I'm kind of in the John Waters camp. I love the filth, the weird stuff. And at the same time, I recognize I can lift my SJW problem glasses and be like, this depiction is very negative on many fronts. But I also, you know, love the movie. As trans people, we are so rarely played by a trans actor or actress. Recently, that's changed a lot. But even in a movie about my life, I was played by a cis gay man. And to have, all the way back in 1970, one of the most beautiful women in the world, Raquel Welch, playing this lead character, that's a giant leap forward. The movie was written by a gay man. That's a giant leap forward. The book. Is Gore Vidal gay? I think he is.
Yes.
Yeah, it was written by a gay man, and I've met Gore Vidal at a party. I didn't get to do more than say hello, but there's so many firsts in this movie that it's really sad that it was so poorly executed on a creative and technical level. There are tons of little inserts of clips of other old media, you know, movies and TV shows and stuff. It's almost like the way Family Guy throws in their little 4 second asides. But for some reason in Myra Breckinridge, it takes me out of the movie. It makes me cringe. And Myra does all these long, you know, speeches that it's very in tune with Gore Vidal's writing style, because he writes like a typewriter made out of cocaine. It's just these long run-on sentences and everything. But I think this could have been a really interesting film. But for me also, it's important to remember, anybody who hasn't seen it, a young man transitions to a gorgeous goddess and sort of comes back to Hollywood to get his revenge and have sex, and all these crazy characters show up. But I think in the movie, it's really a gay man's fantasy of what they would do if they looked like Raquel Welch. And that's fine. I'm not hating on that. That would be fun. But it's not really a trans story at all, except just in the technical fact that someone, you know, born male physically transitions to female, and then at the end detransitions in a way, if depending on how you interpret it.
There's so much there that you just said that I want to go in so many different directions. And one of the things that you hit upon that is so part of this film's construction is the utilization of all the clips of old Hollywood. And I think that when considering the approach that this is a gay male fantasy, because you're right, a gay male narrative is different from a trans narrative. And I think that the way that this is constructed, it's almost as if the filmmaker is utilizing the clips of old Hollywood to kind of speak to maybe the gay male worship of divas, if that makes sense. For that reason, it's anomalous, but also this movie that has such queerness doesn't feel like anything more than a queer indictment, despite coming from queer source material. It's like straight filmmakers who make it, who seem to kind of be pointing out, like, look what happens if we let them live their dreams, if that makes sense. Is this all too much at once, or I don't know. I'm not even sure if I have a question yet. I'm just still kind of working through my thoughts on it.
There's a little scene where two of the people who in the movie are Hollywood big shots, they're talking about it's the fags and the dykes and every kind of perversion or putting all this slop out into Hollywood that's corrupting our, you know, straight youth. And in the background, you know, there's a male-female couple having sort of a graphic makeout session with butter spread on them. There's like hippies getting beaten by the police. And, you know, they are trying to make some political statements and they're trying to use comedy to do it. But I don't know why it just doesn't quite gel for me.
We're all on the same page there, where I'm completely fascinated by the movie because I think the intention in many ways was to actually be progressive and to do something different. And certainly I think that the point of casting Raquel Welch speaks to the fantasy of it. And that is a queer fantasy and a queer male fantasy. You know, I've had many gay male friends, one of whom, the late great Heklina, constantly talked about how she wished she was a woman, but only so that she could get fucked by straight guys. And she would have been completely satisfied. We would see beautiful women and Heklina would say, how is she not just getting fucked right now? This movie kind of speaks to that in a way, that you've got the revenge for being bullied. You've got, you know, sort of the fantasy and the erotic kick of dominating a straight guy, which we'll get to that scene, of course. But also, you've got like Mae West doing musical numbers for no reason.
She's doing her sextet character, but like 8 years before she did sextet.
Right.
It's amazing.
And the director, I think, just didn't know how to do it. So it's just this kind of messy, confusing film that I do think was well-intentioned in many ways. But I wanted to kind of get back to the idea of Raquel Welch and sort of the fantasy of it all. when you look at the idea of trans woman existing in the world the way we know today, it could be anybody, right? We know trans women that are drag queens. We know trans women that are plumbers. Trans women are like any other women. They come in all different shapes and sizes and types. When you look at Raquel Welch, this is not only the fantasy of what it would be to be a trans woman from a gay man's point of view, it's the fantasy women had of being a woman. She is so gorgeous and so well costumed. Are you a fan of Raquel Welch? And what do you think of her performance in the film?
Oh, yeah. Everyone back up a step so I can drop a name. I don't need to do this, but I was fortunate enough to become personal friends with Jane Fonda. Ooh. Because her son, you know, played my boyfriend in the movie Soldier's Girl. And I've gotten to spend a lot of time with Jane. I've cooked Christmas dinner at her house. I was her nanny for a month when we shot Monster in Law. And one night I had just had a Raquel Welch movie marathon. I had this, you know, really low res projector digital. We were playing, you know, 10,000 BC and all these Raquel Welch movies. We didn't play Myra. And I admit I was being a little bitchy for no reason. Do you ever do that? You just like, why was I a bitch? But I was like, well, we had a Raquel Welch marathon last night. And Jane was like, huh, did it hold up? You know, she's an amazing actress and a beautiful girl. And I was like, yeah, it did hold up. She is a beautiful girl and an amazing actress. And I think having her play this role illustrates something that a lot of people don't realize is that very few people, almost nobody I know, want to be a transsexual, quote unquote. They want to be a woman. And so, you know, having a woman play this role is the maximization of that fantasy. It's not that they wanted to be a trans woman. They wanted to be a woman, and there it is, a woman.
I think that her in this movie as a larger-than-life character is something that we, in terms of worshippers of cult cinema and fabulous characters like Frankenfurter or Nomi Malone or the people who kind of existed at 10 always, there's a point in this movie where I feel like we as queer audience, as cult audience, are very much on board with Myra. Like, I think that if we don't get the last act of the movie, this might have been one of those roles for Raquel Welch that forever and always would be like the rock and roll movie screening kind of thing. But then we go sort of into the straight panic ending with the rape sequence and the idea that queer people can only devolve into villainy and sexual perversion. And I think that it's probably a no-brainer question, but do you think that the last act of the movie is ultimately what makes this movie so kind of hard to handle still?
It is really unfortunate that those tropes, you know, end up closing out the film. I think if you look at 70s cinema, you had a lot of shocking sexploitation, you know, Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS, and Salo, and things like that. And then you have these big, crazy omnibus films like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, where there's just a billion things going on, and they try to throw everything in the pot, you know, without editing better. But yeah, I mean, there's a rape scene in the film, which is awful and not how anybody wants to be represented, much less a trans woman. And some people make the argument that, you know, as a trans woman, if you even sleep with somebody without telling them that you transitioned, that you have raped them. So that scene, you know, kind of double stacks that concept, because she's not disclosing that she's trans and she's also actually raping this young man. And then she has sex with his ex-female partner. And, you know, on the one hand, I don't want to be, you know, portrayed as always perfect, the Mary Sue, you know, a trans woman can't ever do anything bad or wrong. But when there's so little representation, it would be nice to counterbalance by treading a little softly unless it just has to happen in the service of some really well thought out narrative.
I think that makes total sense. And as a person who was coming of age, you know, growing up in Maryland and being obsessed with John Waters, there is this group of us that as queer people, we identified with the renegades and the dirty people and the punks and the outlaws and the shock value. But I remember kind of being taught, you know, by older queer people, look, these bigger images of us are problematic. And here's why. And I was in college in the era of Basic Instinct and The Silence of the Lambs, two movies that I really loved, especially The Silence of the Lambs. You know, so for someone to tell me that Buffalo Bill was problematic when I enjoyed Buffalo Bill so much because I was just so twisted, I think that now in hindsight, I'm able to look at all these things and go, oh, you know, there is a difference between divine shooting people and tarring people and eating shit and all this stuff when it was made by queer people, celebrating queer people, or even Frankenfurter, you know, who does problematic things in that film. You know, he sexually seduces people in a kind of a rapey way, and he murders Meatloaf and serves Meatloaf to a table of people. Like, but because they were made by queer people, there was this sort of celebratory joy. But when they're put out by big Hollywood studios and they're disseminated across the world, you know, and they're using transphobia and homophobia as a tool of fear, it was sort of like, oh, okay, I get it. And I think with this movie in particular, it's interesting. I keep coming back to this comparison. And our other guest pointed out that both films were being shot on the same lot at the same time, which is my love of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which also features a problematic trans representation. But for whatever reason, I love Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. You know, I embrace it. And Z-Man / Superwoman, you know, and the whole Manson finale and all of it, is fucked up as it is, I just love that movie. To me, it's one giant celebration. Whereas I want to love Myra Breckinridge in a way that I just find it just doesn't add up for me.
Yeah, this particular movie is a real kind of monkey wrench thrown in where I have to think so hard about it that maybe it's that you have to think so hard about it that it starts killing the fun. When I'm watching Divine or whatever, I'm like in shock and I'm loving her and I'm wishing I was her. And I don't know, with Myra Breckinridge, even though it's based on a book by a gay man and the movie's written by a gay man, it does feel really hetero to me in a way.
Yeah, it does. I'm wondering about the comparison between Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and Myra Breckinridge, is if it's exactly what we're talking about, the idea that the Hollywood studio is the establishment, is the mainstream, is representing heteronormative views, even if they're doing a queer narrative. And the difference being that Russ Meyer, everything we know about Russ Meyer is that he celebrates sleaze, that sleaze is okay. Sleaze is not something to be ashamed of. Even though some of the sleazy characters in his movie get punished in different ways, everybody's sleazy. So that's sort of like the median norm. And that's then not the problem. Whereas this movie, it's like if you look askance of the mainstream, anything outside of a certain set of values, it's sort of like that's a sleaze that... look at what the weirdos in Hollywood are doing. And I'm wondering if that's sort of the difference. Now, we're building up to this question in some ways, and we're already addressing it, but we talk about movies like Basic Instinct. On the show, we've covered Cruising. We know that movies like Silence of the Lambs and Sleepaway Camp, these are movies that have problematic elements but have been reclaimed by our communities in different ways. People celebrate them. Is there a path or a way that Myra Breckinridge is a movie that's reclaimed, do you think?
It's already in the camp pantheon. It's just not S tier. It's not all the way at the top like Faster Pussycat or John Waters or something. It is in there. It is a fun watch. You know, I would tell people, do put it on your list. What do y'all think?
The reason we're covering it is because it deserves to be like noted and looked at. Because it's so fascinating, because of the Raquel Welch, Gore Vidal, Rex Reed, Mae West of it all. But I think you can both go, this is enjoyable because it's fascinating. And also, what was going on? I actually had never thought about the rape scene the way that you just contextualized it in the time period that the movie came out, and bringing up movies like Sallow and what was the other one you said?
Ilsa,
can you imagine, you know, the cancel culture youth of today, like, you know, screening Ilsa for them? Like, you know, it just
it would
blow their minds. And also, this is the era of blaxploitation where Pam Grier is doing insane things that are so wildly entertaining. But the rape scene in particular, I'm thinking about like Ken Russell and The Devils and those movies where they were designed to push the limits of what a viewer could take. And in many ways, I do now see that scene and go, oh, this wasn't alone in the time period that it came out. There was a lot of this sort of challenging stuff that was there just to be challenging.
What was the movie? Was it The Deer Hunter, where, you know, the male on male rape scene in the forest? It seems like there were several movies coming out in the 70s that really featured this. I think what it's meant to convey is an emasculation. For Myra, it's a revenge. This book and this movie, they feel like they were written by somebody who hates Hollywood. And, for Rex Reed, he's a movie critic. So I can see, you know, if you're a movie critic, you've got a lot of hate, of vitriol to spill on Hollywood. And this whole movie, it's showing predatory acting teachers and dumb actors who are just getting by because they're hot, and the business of the sleaze, the sex. It's really not a love letter to Hollywood, it's a hate letter to Hollywood. But for some reason, it's written by a trans woman in the movie.
Yeah.
The whole of our show, Midnight Mass, is we have a blanket trigger warning, we say, because cult movies by their very nature are subversive. So there's something that bucks against the air quotes norm with every movie we cover to some degree. And that's what also drew the niche. And I think that for a movie like this, to try and take it out of the moment in which it was made and review it through the lens of today, it would be a complete disservice to the film, but also the context of the era and our growth as a queer community and just a film community. And I think that with that and this conversation, it's like, yeah, we can't strike it from the record. It's why we're covering it. It's why in some ways we're celebrating aspects of it. And you said there are parts of this movie that you think are fun. And I think that's true. There are some really fun parts about this movie. So we've gotten really heavy. We've gotten into some serious stuff. But what do you love about this movie? What do you love about Myra Breckinridge?
It's a little put in the cart before the horse, but anything Mae West is in, I rewatch her movies on a loop just as comfort food for the soul. And she's here as this sexually empowered, predatory agent, again, you know, taking a hit at Hollywood, but swapping the genders in another way, because usually the predatory Hollywood agent is male taking advantage of starlets. And here it's not a trans portrayal, but it's a female agent, you know, who's has these gorgeous men lined up. And she just does all her trademark little things. She never looks at the other actors. Her face is always to the camera. And it's always like, oh, remind me of when the policeman's balls. You know, I just love that. And I love looking at Raquel Welch. She's just so beautiful. And the 70s was hit or miss for makeup, but they did her perfectly. Her makeup would work today. It's, you know, neutrals, nothing crazy, a good line on the eyeliner. And her outfits, sometimes she copies like a Marlene Dietrich pantsuit. She has like an American Velvet riding outfit. It is a feast for the eyes, as one might say.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's where we find the queerest sensibilities is in the sort of the fabulousness. Like Raquel Welch being this idealized woman with perfect clothes and perfect makeup, like you said, and perfect hair, and just being sassy and confident and fabulous. And Mae West, again, another gay male fantasy, running that company, you know, and getting to dress in drag, you know, full drag to go to work like every day, looking amazing and having the hottest men come into your boudoir office. Hello. It's fantastic and delicious. Not to mention, we get introduced to Tom Selleck, of course, very, very briefly.
Oh, yes, yes. And Mr. Thurston Howell is there.
Yes, oh, yeah. Yes, exactly. And we get to get all those Mae West lines delivered perfectly, you know, after 27 years, you know, the 6'7", you know, line.
And I'm only interested in the 7".
I mean, who is that for, if not gay guys?
She's like a robot of perfect quotable line delivery. She's so old at that point and so surgeried and a million corsets and wigs and pounds of makeup. And yet she still rolls out there and is completely captivating, delivers just the ultimate goddess. When I started doing drag in the early 90s, my inspirations were Morticia Adams, Elvira, and Mae West. And, amazing. You know, they haven't let me down.
And I think if anything, when you look at sort of the two power structures in the movie, you've got Mae West and John Huston, and she's presented as the utmost of fabulousness, and he's an utter buffoon. And so if anything, at that point in the movie, up until the end, that is a queer, you know, fantasy. Like, Mae West is the power that we want. John Huston is the power that we get in the world, you know? And I think that he's a really interesting part of this film. I mentioned in our other interview how we know historically he had some homophobia issues of his own based on how he treated Montgomery Clift, but it's quite interesting that he was in this movie. What's your take on his performance?
I liked it. I mean, he's an archetype. If you go back to Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, you know, very early on, there's like the guy who owns the little TV station she works at. He's like this kind of hefty cowboy dummy and comes in and he tries to flirt with Elvira and she like slaps him, knocks him down. And he's like, you said she was a nympho. And it's that kind of gross Hollywood executive who just, you know, barrels in dumb as a rock, thinks they can have every girl just because they got the money and the power. And that's an archetype, I guess, you know, Weinstein just got thrown in prison. We're still looking at the Epstein client list. Those people are still here 50 years later. Myra came out in 1970. So yeah, we use archetype to explore these issues. And that sounds so academic, sorry. But I think he handled it capably.
I agree. I think he actually is another example of why I like the movie is because, well, it's satire. It's a meta, I guess, because he was the archetype of maleness in Hollywood for so long. And then to turn around and to play a buffoon, you know, to play a disgusting, ridiculous cartoon character where you can tell he's in on the joke, you know, he gets it. And he knows he's making fun of probably men that he knew at the time and lampooning them, you know. I think it's another reason the movie succeeds. One thing I was thinking about when talking about this film, and I was thinking about how I read something about how Leonard Maltin, I forget what he said, but it was something along the lines of like, this is one of, if not the worst movies ever made. Basically, he hated it so much that he just said, and I was thinking about it. I was like, critics like that, I just don't get, because to me, boring, forgettable movies are bad movies.
Yeah.
This is not that. This is still fascinating all these years later. And here we are talking about it. And this is a lot of the cult movies that we cover. They don't like the movies we cover often, you know. But this movie is still fascinating. This movie gave us Farrah Fawcett, who has said that she spent most of her time on set crying in her dressing room because her theory was that Raquel and May hated each other so much and they were, you know, at each other's throats so much, but Farrah was the unifying target. So apparently took a lot of their ear. And also all of these sorts of on-set rumors about catfights and divas, it all makes for great Hollywood lore.
Can you imagine doing a Mean Girls type exercise with Mae West and Raquel Welch as the Mean Girls bullying Farrah Fawcett? Wow.
I think that's probably what it was for the sound of it. Yeah.
which is a shame that she had to go through that. But she's so beautiful, too. You know, I was born in 71. I grew up in the late 70s, early 80s. And all the boys I had crushes on had the Farrah Fawcett poster in their bedroom or the Raquel Welch poster. And they were such ideals at that time. Farrah seemed clean and pure, and Raquel seemed a little more come hither. But
right. Well, it's interesting that they each in their way sort of represented that archetype of the decades where they really rose to prominence. When you think of Mae West and her time in the 30s and 40s, but obviously Raquel Welch really became the sex symbol because of the prehistoric movies that she did with Hammer. And this movie kind of ends that chapter and leads us into Farrah. I get it. I get why they were at war. It's like Baby Jane, right? They could have been friends, but no.
All this time, we could have been friends.
Oh, gosh. Now, Calpurnia, this is switching gears, but I did want to bring it up because, of course, I follow you on social media and I am a big fan. But I love something that you shared, which is about another movie that we have not yet covered on Midnight Mass. But you shared a little detail about the movie Alien on social media.
Yes. Oh, right.
Which I had forgotten about. Darren Stein is obsessed with Alien. Darren Stein, the writer and director. And Darren
I've
had
met
told
him
me
one time.
Yeah. Oh, have you? Yeah. Well, he's amazing. Anyway, why don't you tell the story? Because you shared it the other day and I think it's so fascinating and worth noting.
Well, of course, all of us are mega Aliens fans. Yes. And I probably rewatch Alien and Aliens several times a year just as another comfort watch. And it turns out Lambert, played by Veronica Cartwright in the first movie, in the second movie, there's a blink and you'll miss it little screen of her employee profile, and it says that she was trans. The thing says she was born male and switched to female via some medical process they named in the future. And it's really interesting to me because that movie came out a long time ago. They didn't have to do that. They never made a big deal out of it. She's arguably a flawed character. She was kind of a coward in a lot of ways, but she was a real character and person. And I think those cool little blips are so interesting because sometimes we see it in this sort of megalithic way of like, there was no trans representation before X year. And there were little dribs and drabs out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as a postscript to that, I used to host another show back in the day called Dead for Filth, and Veronica was a guest. I had Veronica Cartwright on. And when she came on the show was right around the time I think someone had first kind of found that, and it was like making its rounds on the internet. And we started talking about Alien, and she said, she's like, well, are you going to ask me about this new thing? And I was like, well, only if you want to talk about it. And she was like, I obviously didn't know they did that. And she said, so it was something I discovered after the fact, but she loved it. She's like, I think that's great. You know, and it was really fun to get her take on it. And she's just like, you know what? I think that it just expands the world and it's the future. So
sure. And I love hearing that. And I love that about her. As long as somebody's just not outright horrible, mean, hateful, like Susan B. Anthony probably would not support teenage transition, but that doesn't mean that I don't think Susan B. Anthony is cool. And, you know, there's all kinds of people of their moment, of their time, of their education and background. You know, somebody who grew up in the Appalachian Mountains in the 20s, they're not going to understand what I am. And I think if they spent a week with me and I made my cornbread and grits for them, you know, they would fall in love with me. But I'm not going to go back in time and look at things people said 50 years ago or they did, unless it was just outright awful, mean, hateful. I try to see context.
Right. That makes total sense. Well, Calpurnia, I know that I have just brought up your social media, and I know that our listeners now are going to want to know, how can folks stay up with you and keep up with what you're putting out there?
I am named after three people. Julius Caesar's wife in actual history was Calpurnia, also in Shakespeare. In To Kill a Mockingbird, the surrogate mother for Jim and Scout was Calpurnia. And in the Addams Family Wednesday's great aunt Calpurnia was burned as a witch in 1706. But I spell it differently. I spell it Calpernia. And if you look at Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube.com, if you just put Calpernia in there, you'll find me. And I post a lot of cooking and my silly parrots and occasional insight into culture and the zeitgeist.
Well, Calpurnia, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about Myra Breckinridge and for providing your insight. We really appreciate it. This was a true gift. Thank you.
Well, thank y'all for having me, and let's grab a coffee sometime, or if you need a dinner cooked, let me know.
Absolutely. And that was our interview with the fantastic goddess that is Calpurnia Addams. As I said, big, big fan here. So I'm so glad we were able to have her on the show. She was really able to speak to a fandom of this film in a way that really makes sense, you know? I really liked what she said about it. It isn't a movie that tells a trans story. It's a movie that tells a gay male fantasy story about what it would be like to be trans. And I think when you kind of go, oh yeah, that is what it is, it's easier to kind of accept it as almost farce in a way. But yeah, if you're looking to this movie to tell the story of the trans experience, you're not going to find it.
Now, one thing that's really interesting is during the interview, we deviated a little bit, and Calpurnia talked about aliens and Alien and sort of the connection between them. But did you know, Peaches, that there is an alien connection directly to Myra Breckinridge?
No, do tell.
Yes. As I mentioned in the opening, one of the credited writers of the screenplay is a man named David Giler. And this was David Giler's first screenplay, which was really, really well received in screenplay circles, but then taken by Michael Sarn and heavily rewritten. And then we sort of know what happened. But it allowed David Giler to go on and have a career. One of the films that he ended up co-writing 9 years later was Alien. And as he was co-writing Alien, he also became one of the executive producers and stayed a producer of the Alien franchise for the rest of his life. He sadly has passed away. He also founded a company with Walter Hill of the Warriors and Streets of Fire fame, and they produced Tales from the Crypt.
Wow. So,
from Myra Breckinridge, these two really kind of other great genre kingdoms were built.
That is not where I thought you were going. When you introduced this concept, I thought you meant that there was like some sort of alien character or storyline in the movie Myra Breckinridge that I had missed.
No, maybe no, no. That,
yeah.
It was just one of the co-writers of Alien and Alien 3. I guess he wrote that as well. Co-writers, co-creators of that franchise was the person responsible for the first version of the script that got this movie sold. So
I thought that that was really interesting that Calpurnia had shared that, and it had nothing to do with anything other than a trans character that I think a lot of people never read as trans, you know.
Right.
If you're a listener of the Midnight Mass podcast, you stan Veronica Cartwright. We all love Veronica Cartwright, who plays that character in Alien. You know, Michael, at some point we have to tackle Alien on this show.
We do.
It's kind of crazy that we haven't, but it's one of those big ones that, like, you know, it's just on our very, very long list. But let's get back to Myra Breckinridge, because one of the things that I have to say is so ludicrous about this film and makes no sense. And I don't know if you thought this when you rewatched it. And I don't know why I'd never really thought, or I probably thought about it before, but if you watch this film, the film starts with a sort of flashback sequence where you're seeing Myra receive her gender-affirming surgery in this ridiculous way.
Right.
It is very graphic. It's the way the movie opens. But then at the end of the movie, when she decides to reveal her truth to Uncle Buck, that's his name, right?
Yes. That's John Huston.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, because Uncle Buck is also
like John Candy.
Yeah. So there's an Uncle Buck in this movie played by John Huston. She gets up on his desk and lifts up her skirt. Seemingly, I think the audience is supposed to believe that she's, you know, revealing male genitalia, but it makes no sense. Did that bother you at all? Like, you know, I was watching it going, wait, this makes no sense. What is she showing him exactly?
Well, it's interesting because I think the movie, and we talk about this in some degree with both of our guests, is a fantasy in that we don't really know what's true and what's not. The whole movie is kind of couched in this continued use of Hollywood clips that show Myra's fantasy of Hollywood and what she believes Hollywood looks like versus what it is. We get the idea that Myra is an unreliable narrator because she is. We don't know exactly what is fact and what is fiction because everything about the world she lives in is heightened reality. I mean, Mae West is a cartoon to some degree, a fabulous cartoon, but a cartoon nonetheless. But so is John Huston. So is that studio. That studio would never be able to fucking produce a movie the way it's being run. It's a mess. But it's just the idea that everything's just like The Muppet Show, but like an X-rated Muppet Show where everything's just crazy always. And it's fabulous and strange and fun. And what I think we want the fantasy to be. So I think in the end, if things don't entirely line up, of course they don't, because dreams don't make sense. It's like the David Lynch vision of Hollywood is that Hollywood is always a little bit fractured and a little bit broken and things don't line up. And this is sort of like kind of in a way Lynchian before Lynch.
Well, you know, I went to look to see what had been said about that just to see if it made any sense. This is what Wikipedia says about it. Buck continues his investigation, ultimately uncovering evidence that Myron never died and that no death certificate exists for him. Confronted with the truth, Myra admits to the truth and strips naked before a horrified Buck. Uncle Buck's response indicates that Myra did not have her testes removed during her sex change. What? Anyway, that is what's on Wikipedia. We don't really need to go much further other than to say this is just part and parcel for how bonkers, bananas, and wild Myra Breckinridge is. Because if you're queer at all or know any trans women, this just doesn't add up. But, you know, no. Who cares? It, like Michael said, it is a heightened reality. It is an insane kaleidoscope of almost a cartoon. Now, that being said, one, this episode that we're doing is hot on the heels of our Hagsploitation episode, and that is by design. Yes. As you know, if you listen to the Hagsploitation episode, we discussed, you know, what that genre is and how it all worked. We actually have an interesting thing going on here with the casting of Mae West. And, yes. And it is so important to our love and our interest of Myra Breckinridge that Mae West appears in a film 27 years after her last film appearance. And she is Mae West. And she's not appearing in the film as a monster or as a psychotic, unhinged woman. She's appearing as Mae West, you know, the
like
Mae West
siren,
the one that you saw 30 years ago, you know. It is so fascinating. By the way, if you did listen to that Hagsploitation podcast, then you probably know that we are leaving a special mini mass up to the listeners. If you're a Patreon subscriber, you've already voted on a poll. We are putting out midnight mini masses regularly. So if you want more midnight mass, join our Patreon. You get the extra stuff. There's an extra Hagsploitation episode either already released or on its way. And with this episode that we're currently working on, Mae West doesn't fit into Hagsploitation. She is an older woman who was featured in a movie as if she were still in her prime. It is fascinating. It is also bonkers and bananas. And our next guest is the perfect guest to discuss it.
Much like those women, it's by Mae West's own design. We know that Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, they had control. They were the ones who pushed forward Baby Jane. I talked in the last episode about how Debbie Reynolds was the person who pushed forward What's the Matter with Helen, and Shelley Winters herself was the one who made sure that the movies she was in happened. And here's Mae West. She came in, she had control. She said, this is how I want to play it. This is what I'm going to be. You don't tell me how I am. You don't tell me I'm old. I'm this. I write my lines. I wear this. And that's fierce. And in its way, it's a great connector between last week and this week, because it's truly the reverse side of the coin in some ways.
Absolutely. So we didn't have to look far to find, you know, the biggest Mae West fan I know. It's my downstairs neighbor and longtime friend. It's Mad Magda, a.k.a. David Des Moines, the biggest Mae West fan in the world. And he is about to talk to us all about his love affair with Mae West right now.
Baby, here I am. I'm a girl on the scene. I can give you what you want, but you gotta come home with me. I've got some real good loving and I've got some in store. When I get through throwing it on you, you gotta come back for more. Girls and things will come by the dozen. That ain't nothing but bookstore loving. Good looking thing loving, light your candle, cause baby, I'm sure how to handle. Yes, I am.
Well, hello, everybody. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce our next guest. This is a dear personal friend, someone who took me into their home when I was literally homeless way back when. That's another story for another day. This person, when I moved to San Francisco, had one of the coolest businesses, the most San Franciscan business I could ever imagine. It was Mad Magda's Russian Tea Room, where drag queen and trans psychics hung out and worked and sold coffee and put on shows and did tarot readings. It was amazing. And also was a performer. She was a performer back in the day, but I've gotten to know them outside of their drag persona. And now I've taken them into my building where they live downstairs in an apartment that was formerly inhabited by the most flawed and tragic drag queen in all of San Francisco, Martini. It is a very Tales of the City situation over here. I could go on and on. But the reason we have this person on today's show is because I know no bigger fan of Mae West than our next guest. And so we've invited them to come on the show. And without further ado, I would like to introduce the one, the only, it's Mad Magda, aka David DeMoyton. Welcome, David, to the show.
Yay. I am so happy to be here. Thank you for the wonderful introduction, dear old friend.
No problem.
And neighbor.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here on the show, especially to talk about this curiosity in Mae West's career, because she had had somewhat of a break in between making films before coming to do Myra Breckinridge.
26 years.
And of all the movies to make, this, of course, is a highly controversial one. It was, in some ways, a pointed decision. Before we get to the Myra Breckinridge of it all, can you speak a little bit about your fandom of Mae West and maybe where this movie lands in her filmography for you?
Well, it's very interesting because when I was going into probably sixth grade, we moved from Akron, Ohio to Quincy, Illinois, of all places. And my father was an arts administrator and he got a job there. So we lived there. And at that time, probably at the age of 12 or 13, they started showing on one of the TV stations in the Saturday afternoons, the Mae West W.C. Fields show. Basically, they would rotate between Mae West and W.C. Fields every week. And I became obsessed with Mae West, being a 12-year-old closeted. Well, I didn't even know I was a queen, but boy, I just became totally obsessed with her. I was like, who is this woman? She was just like in control of everything. And she was ruling the roost. She basically did what men did in a lot of movies and in images. She was actually in control of everything. She was hilarious. She was funny. It was great. I just totally fell in love with her. And that was really right around the time of Myra Breckinridge. And I used to write her fan letters. And I actually, with some friends, we called the Ravenswood, her apartment building, because she listed her phone number in the phone book.
Oh, my God.
Of course, it was answered by the receptionist at the Ravenswood. I'm sorry, Miss West is at her Malibu house right now. But I wrote to her. She wrote back.
Wow.
She sent me an autographed still from Myra Breckinridge. Said to David, Sin-Searly, Mae West. And I actually got a second one that was for another friend, and it was Sex-Searly, Mae West.
Wow.
And then she also sent me an envelope that had a bunch of, I guess it was like this mimeographed copy of all these different things you could buy in the Mae West fan club, and it was sprayed with her perfume.
Oh, wow. Now, the big question is, do you still have any of this stuff?
Unfortunately, not. In my reckless, drug-addled 20s, I lost them along the way, and that's the big sadness for me.
It's a life regret.
This day, it's a life regret.
Because I was sitting here thinking, like, yeah, you know, I've heard these stories before, but I would imagine that if you still had them, I would have seen them by now, but I've never seen them.
Absolutely.
I would have smelled them by now. Yes. Oh, that's the
one that really hurts, is I don't have the envelope with her perfume on it, but I can still in my senses smell that perfume. And I could imagine that her whole Ravenswood apartment was reeking of that scent.
Yeah.
Fascinating woman. And this film is kind of crazy.
Yeah. Before we jump into the film, which we will, I think because we haven't covered her yet on this particular podcast, I think taking some time to acknowledge that this is one of the women who I think I could define as a drag queen in terms of what came first, the chicken or the egg. Was she inspired by drag queens of the era and she brought that sensibility to Hollywood? Because the comedy of it, the sexual innuendo, it is so infused with what we understand to be drag comedy, drag culture, which we know has existed forever, right? You know, but Mae West was so brilliant at it and she became so famous for it. I just want to acknowledge that this is, especially if you're a younger listener, maybe your entrance to Mae West was through Alaska Thunderfuck, who did Mae West on RuPaul's Drag Race very well, in fact.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, David, as a person who did grow up to adopt a drag persona, how much of Mae West do you think has inspired drag over the years? And do you think that Mae West, much like other women we know, such as Cassandra Peterson, Elvira, Mink Stole, you know, these women that we love so much, those women we know were surrounded by drag queens. Was Mae West surrounded by gay men? Do you know?
Absolutely. She didn't come to Hollywood till she was almost 40. Her first film was a walk-on role in a George Raft film called Night After Night. And she was probably 39 at that time, which was very late to come into that business. But she was a huge star in Broadway. And she had written some scandalous plays, one called Sex,
yes,
which landed her in jail for 8 days. Big publicity for her.
Amazing.
And then she also produced another play, which only appeared out of New York. It was like in New Jersey, called The Drag.
Wow.
She was not in it. It was all drag queens. And she wrote that. And the police said, you cannot bring this show into New York. You will cause riots. We cannot allow this in New York. So she wrote a play because she obviously loved drag queens and they were huge fans of hers. And they always have. And she loved drag queen impersonations of her. Probably the only impersonations that she really did like. She hated it when other women did her. She really didn't like that at all. It was very competitive, but she loved it when the drag queens did her.
Well, it's interesting because then it becomes cyclical, right? You know, she's inspired by drag queens are inspired by her. And if we look at the trajectory of her career, when she goes to Las Vegas and does the Las Vegas shows where it's her and all the muscle men, and it basically was a thing in Hollywood where if someone was in a sword and sandal movie playing Hercules or Samson, they probably started with Mae West flexing while she was doing a number in Vegas. And we know Mickey Hargitay did it. Mark Forrest from Son of Samson did it. And then I look at some of the drag performers of today. It's like what the Boulay brothers do with Israel and Ian, having like muscle men around them to kind of enhance their drag in some ways. I love that her influence is still felt. And one thing, Peaches, when you were talking that I wanted to remark upon before I forgot about it. Recently, we had a discussion about the hagsploitation subgenre and the idea that there was a certain point where these women who were ingenues of yesteryear couldn't get those roles because they were older. And so they had to create horror movies for themselves or monstrous movies for themselves. And what I really like about Mae West, especially coming to Myra Breckinridge in Sextet, is she sort of holds up a finger and says, no, 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 I'm not only going to keep doing what I am known for, I'm going to do it bigger. Like, she arrives in Myra Breckinridge as the bombshell in a movie with Raquel Welch. And so I think that's really fascinating that she never relinquished control of her image and it carries through to the end. I see you nodding, so surely you have some thoughts about that.
Absolutely. From what everything I've read about her entrance into Myra Breckinridge is they approached her to play Letitia Van Allen, the agent. And they offered her a salary of $350,000. She got top billing. She was actually above Raquel Welch in the movie.
It's her name in the credits. It comes up first.
She got top billing, and she was given permission to write all of her own scenes.
which is insane. And the other thing that we should note is that to write her own scenes when it's taken from a novel written by Gore Vidal is just, I would love to have seen those conversations. $350,000, first of all, for that time, for a woman, is extraordinary.
Yeah.
To be able to write your own scenes, extraordinary. To get top billing at her age, at this time, extraordinary. So, Myra Breckinridge, how did you connect with that film when you first saw it? And what's your experience with Myra Breckinridge? Because I think all three of us can agree, it isn't necessarily one of those cult movies that we have on Midnight Mass because we all absolutely love every bit of it, but we are absolutely fascinated by it.
Yes.
So what's your relationship with Myra Breckinridge like, David?
Well, my relationship with Myra Breckinridge is I started becoming a Mae West fan around the time of Myra Breckinridge. And it was a huge deal that, oh, wow, she's coming out with a new movie. So the fascination of Myra Breckinridge was really Mae West is returning to the screen. I was obsessed with Mae West at the age of, we're talking about the age of 13. So
right.
That would have been my initial obsession with that movie. I don't even remember when I actually saw it because it was rated X.
Right.
So I probably didn't even actually see the movie till later. I'd probably seen stills and read articles about it. Circling back to about the salary that she received, actually in 1933, she was the top paid star. And actually, she was the second highest earning person in the United States. In the middle of the Depression, the only person that made more than her was William Randolph Hearst. Basically, Paramount Studios was in big trouble at that time, and she single-handedly saved that studio. Her films did. You have to also realize she only made about 8 films in the 30s. Her filmography is very small. She made about 8 films, but her impact was so profound because there was no one like her. She was definitely an individual. So fast-forwarding to Myra Breckinridge, she had such a cachet and such a reverence in Hollywood. I guess she could get away with it. The studios allowed it. They said, yes, we'll do anything to get Mae West on film. And she was probably a draw. And I think the premieres in New York, like 10,000 fans came up. Most of them were coming to see Mae West reappear on the screen.
Which is interesting because we know that the making of this movie, when you look into the history of it, was tumultuous to say the least. There were a lot of problems behind the scenes. And one of them is kind of in some ways speaking directly to what you're talking about. If one person didn't have reverence for Mae West, it was Raquel Welch. They did not get along. And I feel like the feeling was mutual from Mae West to Raquel. And it's interesting because they are sort of foils in this movie who never really share a scene together.
Mae West wouldn't allow to be shot with her side by side. That was not allowed.
They awesome. Are in that one cafe scene together. And David, you and I watched the film together in preparation for the podcast the other night, which was really fun because David had all this great trivia. So it was like having a running commentary track where for the first time ever, I allowed her to speak incessantly during a movie. Film. I was very generous.
They are in that cafe scene together, but it's mostly sides of conversation. So you never really see them like in a medium.
You see them in a double shot when, but Raquel's back is to the camera. So that's
an over-the-shoulder shot.
It's an over-the-shoulder shot.
But tell this story about the color of their garments, because that's an interesting part of that scene.
So Raquel Welch, for that scene, she had this beautiful black dress made for that scene. And when she was going to go and get it to try it on, it disappeared from her dressing room. It wasn't there. And the producers came out and said, I'm sorry. Mae West confiscated it. The only person to wear a non-color, as Raquel Welch says in her interviews, on the screen would be Mae West, which is black or white. Mae West wore black and white. No one else was to wear that. So she had this horrible red dress sitting in there, and she took it with scissors and cut it to shreds, the red dress. She got her own black dress with the white ruffles that you see in that scene, and she walked into the scene filming with that, and I guess nothing was said. She was like, I'm going to wear this black and white dress. There's some great still photos of Mae West and her together for publicity stills. And Mae West has them standing behind this huge vase of roses. basically to cover their waistlines so she wouldn't be next to Raquel Welch with a teeny waist.
Amazing.
So as we're digging into the movie, obviously the draw in the beginning for you was Mae West and continues to be Mae West. And she is sort of a sun around a lot of things orbit here. But this whole movie is full of unusual casting. Like the fact that she had not made a movie in decades. But then the man, played by Rex Reed, who is not an actor and known primarily to be a film critic. You know, you've got all of these sort of unusual casting choices. And so outside of Mae West, what is your overall opinion and feeling of the cast of this movie?
I think it's a very interesting cast. And there's some great old Hollywood actors in it as well. You have John Carradine performing the surgery on Rex Reed, saying that once you cut it off, you can't put it back again. Which is so, like, of course, obviously not what happens in a surgery like that. But the opening scene, it's just so bizarre. I mean, everything is so bizarre. And then the director's use of old 20th Century Fox films, which he just splices into the whole thing, which was always his idea. And then I watched interviews with Michael Sarn. He always wanted to do that. In his defense, he first said no to this film. He had done one film called Joanna, which got some hype. And I guess 20th Century Fox, this is modern. This is what we need, you know. So they brought him out on that film. He wasn't going to do it, but then they flashed $100,000 in his face and he was broke. So he came to Hollywood and did it. And he was in a battle from day one with everyone. So in his defense, I think he was fighting the whole time to do anything. And he had to compromise. And then Mae West wrote her own scenes, had nothing to do with the Gore Vidal's plot.
Right.
Because she gave herself a musical number.
And
she basically, she did. She gave herself fabulous costumes. It was great musical numbers.
And before we get too far away from it, I do want to hit upon the casting of John Carradine, because I love John Carradine. I've loved him since he was a Universal player in the monster movies. He's known for horror films. He's known for playing mad scientists. And I do think that this is an extremely pointed choice in casting in this era to have a doctor who's known for horror, who's known for mad science, perform the sex change at the beginning of the movie. And I think it not only speaks to how the movie is going to handle gender issues for the rest of the fucking run of the film, but it also is like, it opens up this, you know, bee's nest of sexual politics of then and now. And so I just really think it's important because he's not billed at the top of the movie. He's only billed at the end as well.
Mm-hmm.
So
then there's John Huston.
Right.
John Huston, to me, plays the part in a way that makes sense. Yeah. The casting makes sense. He's the archetype of this sort of macho idiot. And I was thinking about this in as many ways as the film is problematic. And wow, is it. And we know that. I mean, it's almost like we don't even have to talk about it, which we should. But it's like... Yeah. It's so problematic, but there's also these interesting things that happen where you go, well, to actually cast Raquel Welch as Myra, you couldn't cast a more beautiful, feminine, almost fantasy of what it means to be a woman than Raquel Welch at this time. I mean, it's almost perfection, you know. The whole thing is just so over the top and so cartoonish, right? That it's interesting. Rex Reed, of course, someone who wasn't out of the closet, but who reads as very much a sissy or queer, you know. It's fascinating, all of this stuff, but how would it have been different? Because I'm assuming the director was heterosexual based on only watching the movie.
I think that's like, a good assumption.
I'm wondering, like, having read the Gore Vidal book, which I love, I actually really love that book. I should reread it. I haven't read it in years. It was one of those early queer, you know, trans experiences I had as far as learning about who Gore Vidal was and reading a book about a trans person. What the movie would have been like if it actually had been directed by a trans person or Gore Vidal, you know, even a queer person. Because the movie in and of itself, it's so bizarre. I can't even figure out like what it's trying to say about any of these things.
What struck me the other night was watching the rape scene.
Yeah.
In that film, that scene is really done well. How disturbing is that scene? And that actor, the one that played
the hunk.
The hunk.
Yeah. He plays it real.
He did a really effective job. I was definitely like feeling for him. It was very uncomfortable to watch that. I hadn't really tuned into that, I think, in years past when I was watching the film, and it was disturbing.
This movie probably hobbled a lot of careers afterwards. You know, Raquel Welch famously struggled to get big movies after this. I think about The Last of Sheila, which she was in, that was written by Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins. And it's sort of the complete inverse of this role. Like, she is the sexpot siren in this movie. And in that movie, she's sort of like the understated movie star who has to sort of pay for her sins. And we know that Sondheim and Perkins wrote each role sort of based on the persona of the actors who played it. And it was like, oh, that's what they thought of her. Like, you know, she still has to pay for this. And that's really interesting. I'm really struck by what Peaches was saying about this being a fantasy. And as we're talking, creating me just sort of like reconsider the film in whole, because maybe the film, even the disturbing parts, are a fantasy in the way that, speaking to what Magda, you were saying about how Michael Sarn cut in clips from old Hollywood. Well, right before Rex Reed really creates the persona that is Myra Breckinridge, what's the last thing we see? We see Raquel Welch in 1 million BC in a film clip inserted by the filmmaker. So it's almost as if it's that queer longing. The thing that I see on the screen is the thing that I want to be. And so then it creates this thing. Is this queer fantasy? Is this trans narrative? Is it all of the above or none of the above? And it makes it more of a complicated gumbo. I don't know that we're going to uncover it in an hour's conversation.
No, but you know, it's interesting. Raquel Welch took on this role because she was known for films like 1,000 Years BC or Million Years BC. She was known for those kinds of roles that were just sexpot roles.
Right.
And she wasn't being taken seriously as an actress. And she thought, well, this is how I'm going to be taken seriously as an actress. And evidently, when they had the first run through and she looked at the script that they had and basically didn't have anything, and she just like, she broke down into tears. And John Huston came up and said, "What's wrong, little girl? What's wrong?" And she goes, "Oh, I don't know. This is just..." Just losing it over what it appeared was going to happen to this film. And he just looked at her and said, "Dear, this is just a movie." Michael Sarn was terrified. And he says so in an interview. He did not want John Huston in that role. He actually wanted Mickey Rooney, which is so bizarre. I kind of think that would have been funny. It would have been an odd choice. But he was very nervous about directing John Huston, understandably so.
I think having John Huston in it is much more subversive, much more transgressive. And really, it's interesting that John Huston's take on it was it's just a movie, because in some ways you think this is a person who had a really rich legacy
right
in this industry, and to do one of your final films this way, making fun of basically the archetype that you played seriously and earnestly, I think that's one of the things that makes Myra Breckinridge all the more fascinating. And also to his dismissive, "It's just a movie." Okay, that's a nice way to look at it. But the reality of it is, we know that movies like this can kill careers. Now, one thing we should note here is there are a couple careers that did not get killed. We haven't mentioned Farrah Fawcett. We haven't mentioned Tom Selleck. So there are these, you know, these other folks that kind of make an appearance here who were able to kind of rise up from the ashes of Myra Breckinridge and have massive, massive. I mean, two of the biggest stars of the 80s are right. Farrah Fawcett and Tom Selleck.
I think that's because they had supporting roles. And right, actually, absolutely. Farrah Fawcett does a very lovely performance in it.
It's good.
Tom Selleck has about two lines and he's not very good at all, but it doesn't matter because he's just kind of a throwaway part. He gets on the casting couch with Mae West. It's kind of ridiculous, but yeah.
Well, here's a question for both of you regarding the John Huston, but also tackling some of the issues and how this movie is perceived. It is interesting that John Huston said yes, but not just because of his legacy and his career. But if you look at the trajectory of his career, he famously had some problems with gay people. When he was making Feud with Montgomery Clift, he basically found Montgomery Clift having sex with a man and went apeshit about it, to the point that it led to a lawsuit in the movie because it would have damaged the film. It was this whole thing. Montgomery Clift never recovered. So there is sort of a matter of record that Huston had a little bit of a homophobic streak. And, you know, maybe he progressed in between the time of making Freud to this. But it is a decided choice if this is something that you have a problem with, that you actually go to war with one of your leading men about, to suddenly be in a movie that's extremely queer. So I'm wondering what your take is on his approach to that. Did he view this as allyship or derisiveness? Who's to say?
It is really who's to say. Who's to say what was going on in his head when he picked this film and how he got cast in that role and why he accepted that role. Of course, there's all sorts of things going on in the background in casting and favors and who knows what transpired to get him to do that role. Or maybe he just needed the money at the time. Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah.
But he did deliver a really convincing performance. He played that character quite well. He did a great job. He was a pro. He was really effective in that role.
One thing I think is worth noting, because this is the Midnight Mass podcast where we tackle all cult movies. I mean, we really stretch and bend the definition of cult movies. One thing that this movie has in a sort of a cult movie definition that we often don't really celebrate here is a so bad it's interesting. I'm not even going to say so bad it's good quality to it. And we often at Midnight Mass, like Michael and I aren't the kind of audience. I'm speaking for Michael. I don't think that you and I are the type that snicker at movies that are so bad and enjoy them. So I won't say that this movie's so bad that I enjoy it. I would say that it's so bad that I'm fascinated by it. And it is because of who all is involved, because it is born of a Gore Vidal novel. And to be fair, if you've read that novel, this movie is nothing like that novel. You know, it just isn't. That novel is actually quite good. It makes sense. At least in my young read of it, it made sense. I watched this movie as a young person and I was baffled by it. I couldn't understand it. The movie upset me.
Well, you and Gore Vidal both.
Gore Vidal famously claims that he never saw the movie. What I understand, he went to his grave saying, I've never seen the movie and I have no interest in seeing the movie. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but he's never admitted to seeing the movie. That being said, I think this kind of a cult movie, it belongs on the Midnight Mass podcast because of the Mae West, because of Raquel Welch, because of Gore Vidal, and because of its trans narrative. But I think we can all agree it is a fascinating car wreck of a movie. It's an interesting thing for this podcast to tackle, because having David on is really important, because one of the reasons we love the movie is because this woman we love is in this movie and it's a significant part of her career. So what's Mae West's takeaway? I want to circle back to where we started. Mae West comes out of retirement, makes this movie. Obviously, she does it for a lot of reasons, the money, the top billing, whatever. But she obviously wouldn't sign on to a movie that she didn't think was probably going to be good for her. She writes her own scenes. She gives herself a musical number. The movie comes out, and then what? David, I think you may have told me a fun story about Mae West in relationship to this movie and her being asked about it after it came out. Am I misremembering that?
You are misremembering that, but she...
It was someone else, wasn't it?
She was disappointed by the film, and mainly because there needed to be more of her on the screen, because she's not in very much...
That's why she's disappointed?
She was disappointed because she wasn't on the screen more. And evidently, there were a lot of scenes, a lot more footage filmed of her that was never put in the film, and they think it's lost. I read something, Michael Sarn might have destroyed it, or who knows? That would be fantastic if they found that footage, but... Yeah, evidently there were a lot more scenes with her and they all ended up on the cutting room floor. But if you look back at the film, you look at her scenes, they have nothing to do with this film. It's all about Mae West. Mae West is just injected into this story and he kind of leaned towards trying to tell the Myra Breckinridge story and it didn't quite work.
I think that it doesn't work, but that's in a way what makes it special too. I mean, it's what drew you to the movie. And to Peaches, your point about neither of us necessarily liking the concept of so bad it's good. I agree. I'm not a fan of the idea of guilty pleasure. I think everything needs to be met on its own terms. And often here on Midnight Mass, we talk about movies that because they're cult films, because they're subversive, there is an element of something that through the lens of time does need discussed. And this movie, I don't even know that it's so bad. It's interesting. I would say it's a spectacle. And
yeah.
Spectacles sometimes are garish and sometimes are fantastic. And this movie is a bit of both. It has some garish ugliness that through the lens of queer time and even immediately needed to be addressed. But also things like Mae West just kind of kicking in and being like, you know what? I'm here now. So this is my movie. And it's like, what's more drag than that? Like, I mean, it's kind of amazing.
The ultimate drag queen. Yes, yes.
It is drag. It is queer. It is a movie that we cannot ignore if we are going to talk about the history of queer placement in cinema. This is important for a number of reasons, but it's also complicated. And one of the things that while David and I were watching it, and David had a really interesting tidbit that I mentioned, and I said, I was like, you know what's interesting about this movie is it came out and it had this sort of ambition to adopt a style. We've not tackled a particular film that we are holding on to, and we will someday. But I said, this to me is like the failed Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, where you look at a master like Russ Meyer and the sort of extreme spectacle of a movie like Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, the style of it, what it was trying to say, the times in which it was made, the edits, the way he was doing the editing. There's a lot of similarities. And then David tells me these two movies were being shot at the same time on the same lot.
Absolutely. Evidently, there was a big waft of marijuana in the air because everyone was smoking pot at that time. And in both sets, you had two film critics involved, Rex Reed.
Yeah.
And then you had
Ebert.
Ebert wrote the script there. It was just bizarre. And of course, I don't think that either of these did that well for 20th Century Fox.
No, both were hit with X ratings, right?
Yes, both were hit with X ratings. But I think all these years later, I would consider one to be a masterpiece. You know, one to be one of the best movies ever made. I think Beyond the Valley of the Dolls should be studied. The editing, the style of acting, the colors, everything about it. And it's got trans issues, majorly has trans issues, problematic. Clearly, culture was trying to grapple for the first time ever with some of these ideas in feature films. And somehow, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, all these years later, is immensely watchable as a film. And Myra Breckinridge, I do think of as kind of a cringy disaster that is fascinating and a spectacle and really, really interesting. And I'm glad that we're tackling it. I think we should. But it's kind of like the rape in Showgirls, where you've got this incredible spectacle that is so much fun. And then everything comes to a screeching halt. And I think that David and I both kind of felt like the way that was filmed and the way the actor performed, because he was good,
he really was.
Is so disturbing and so upsetting. And who is that fantasy for? I don't know. It's just really fucked up. And it's playing on every fear that straight people have of queer people.
For all of the narrative issues regarding queerness, up until that point in the movie, Raquel Welch is so still fabulous that you're kind of like, yeah, she's one of those sort of movie characters that we're into because she maybe is devious, but she looks cool. She acts cool. But then there's that. And so close to the end, not that you could ever win someone back after that, but you exit the movie with that in your mind where it's sort of like, it's hard to reconcile the character from that point forward. Regardless, I don't think the movie loses me there, but it's sort of like leaves me in a place where I'm asking myself, how am I supposed to feel about this from this point on? I don't even think the movie knows.
Yeah, going back to the Mae West Raquel Welch feud on the set, evidently it stemmed from Mae West saying to us, well, she's a sweet girl, but no real woman would play that role. that kind of set the tone for their dad relationship. Evidently, she came to the Ravenswood to meet Mae West prior to the film, basically, and she walked in to this white Rococo designed little apartment that she had with all this really kind of over the top furniture. And Mae West walks out with a big wig all wrapped up to the top of her head, and she strutters out And Raquel Welch gets on her knees, basically kisses the ring of Mae West. And she goes, what did you say your name was again, dearie? Basically just dismissed her. So yeah, she didn't care for other women, especially other women that were going to appear in the film as somebody was today's sex symbol or at that time.
Raquel Welch is undeniably just gorgeous. Every generation gets a Raquel Welch, a Michelle Pfeiffer. There's just these people that the camera loves them. Raquel Welch was also just naturally elegant. She was just a star. Before we wrap, you bring up that Mae West makes that snide kind of weird comment about Raquel Welch. But we know that later in life, Raquel Welch kind of went on to report that Mae West may have been a man. And I think that is just so interesting because that is a rumor that if you dig, that is a conspiracy that if you dig around the internet, there is this sort of idea that the Mae West of early Hollywood is not the same person that Mae West is when she appears in Myra Breckinridge. There is a story, a legend, that purports that some gay guy took on the wigs and the everything and became Mae West later in life. Now, did Raquel Welch, is she responsible for this lore?
No, I don't think she's responsible. That's been floating around for years. And I actually had the thrill of seeing Mae West in person here in San Francisco at the Warfield for the premiere of Sextet.
Ooh.
She was escorted by her lover of 30 some odd years, who was an ex-muscle man that was in her act. He escorted her down the runway. She was teeny. I don't believe she was trans at all. That would have been hard to do at her time. And she definitely had shots where she had full cleavage in the 20s, 30s. I just think that that's kind of a farthest rumor because she was such a drag queen in her persona that I think that is what kind of began that rumor. But I don't believe that's the case.
Okay, but did Raquel Welch say that she thought she was a man?
She looked at her hands and she says, there's something about her hands. I just think that she might have been a man. Very teeny man with very large breasts. And you have to think when she was performing as a woman in the 20s and 30s, I didn't have the same kind of things they have today. I don't buy that argument at all.
It just kind of sounds like residual sour grapes more than anything.
As misogynistic as it is, we also as gay men love a cat fight. And there is this thing where we know Bette Davis and Joan Crawford may or may not have been in on the joke, right? So like, there's this thing where it's like, huh, I wonder, you know, with Mae West and Raquel Welch, if part of the sparring might have been publicity.
Here's the bummer about that, like especially Raquel Welch saying it years later. Yeah, there's sort of the draw to the catfight, and that in of itself is problematic. But what I think is a bummer about her saying that specifically is it also is transphobic. It's homophobic.
Absolutely it is.
Well, she also says in an interview, oh, and I saw her and I looked at this, came into her apartment and this woman's all pulled up. She goes, God help me that I never become like that when I'm 77. Well, guess what? When she was 77, she was pulled. She,
yeah, of course.
She was exactly like that. And in the Raquel, she was trying to keep her youthful persona all the way up to the end. So, you know, she did the same thing.
Instead of shaming women who do this, whether it's Mae West, Raquel Welch, or Madonna, or anyone, let's celebrate these fantastic divas who've entertained us and you know, who we've enjoyed so much. And honestly, if it weren't for Raquel Welch and Mae West, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about Myra Breckinridge on Midnight Mass today. It's certainly not the men in this movie, even Rex Reed, you know, that make the movie, you know, fabulous.
He'd probably agree with you 100%.
It's Raquel Welch and Mae West, of course, you know, and that's why we're tackling it on Midnight Mass. So, David, we can't thank you enough. Now, I know that you're not necessarily huge on social media, but our friend Bigsby is... Bigsby is David's dog, who is my nephew, who I watch quite frequently. And Bigsby has his own Instagram account. You can follow Bigsby at Bigsby's Corner. And Magda, where can people follow you?
You can go on to my Facebook account. That's probably the best place to get.
She's old.
I'm okay. Old. Old people use Facebook. I'm old.
Well, we can't thank you enough for coming on and being our guest today and celebrating all things Mae West,
absolutely,
including Myra Breckinridge. Thank you, Mad Magda.
My pleasure. Thank you. Have a great rest of your weekend. Love you.
And that was our interview with the fabulous Mad Magda. I love David so much. And I really, really love David's love of Mae West. The one thing that I just was thinking, because you and I exist in a world where collectors are many, as you know, going to conventions and you having one sheets and I have my own little bits of movie memorabilia, how heartbreaking it is he does not have that Mae West signed artifact anymore, because can you imagine?
It would be amazing. And any true Mae West fan loves is all the fun innuendo and lines that she delivered. And I love that David knows enough about her career to know that most of the dialogue that she wrote for herself for Myra Breckinridge was recycled. Yes. And I think that's fabulous. Yeah. So she really did show up. And what's her name in the movie? Letitia
Van Allen.
Van Allen. Amazing. Basically, she's Mae West. And she's playing Mae West, which I love. So we have had such a good time talking about Myra Breckinridge. I really am so grateful for both of our guests.
Me too.
Obviously, if you're a Patreon subscriber, you know that the conversation's just getting started. So if you are part of the community over at Patreon, we'd love to hear more from you, especially about your thoughts about this movie. It's not a simple one to throw at you. So if you haven't seen it before and you're watching it for the first time, you know, let us know. What did you think?
I think this is one of those movies that we've illustrated all along is tricky, but it's also endured in cultural conversation, in queer conversation for a reason, for better or worse. And for that reason, the fact that cult movie fans return to it every so often is why we wanted to talk about it here today. The truth is, as with every movie we talk about, 90 minutes talking about Myra Breckinridge is probably not enough. So please let us know.
That's right. And if you too meet a stunning stud who happens to be 6'7" and are only really interested in the 7 inches, well, then you too may be one of the children of the popcorn now.
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.